I'd like to talk about the white paper that has been released by the government around the changes to the Mental Health Act. My name is Adele. I am the mum to four children. One of those children has autism and a learning disability and has spent several years as an inpatient in ATUs, where people go, usually when they have the mental health problem, that means they can't stay in the community and they have to go to hospital. And they're usually detained there and they are assessed and treated. Because of our history with that, I am also an expert by experience. So I always find as a curious title, because I think there's lots of things I'd rather be an expert in than this, essentially. Not because it's not good to be an expert, but because the circumstances of getting there. An expert by experience is somebody who has knowledge and understanding of a situation based on their experience. So for me, because my son has spent a long time in assessment and treatment units, we have a lot of experience of how the system works, and that experience can be applied in care and treatment reviews. Hearing about the white paper and being able to read it, it was very outdated previously, and any attempt to make it better is always welcomed. It is recognised that people who have an autistic condition or a learning disability, their needs need to be looked at differently, which I think is definitely progress. I was really encouraged by a lot of conversations around the advocacy service, about the increased amount of attempts you can have to challenge the fact that you're in hospital. I quite liked the advanced choice document. I quite like how that is going to be implemented. So reading within the document, what they're proposing is that before somebody goes into hospital, they would be able to have what's called an advanced choice document. They can set out their own guidelines for what they want, preferences to medication, preferences to a person who can support them, who's not in hospital, things about their finances, about what they'd like to happen at crisis point, about advocacy. It's about making sure that before you go into hospital and before things are more difficult, you've had time to rationally make some decisions that will work for you. I'm quite worried that at the moment, you know, anybody can be sectioned. That includes people with autistic conditions and learning disabilities. And moving forward, it said that from when this new act is implemented, that people with autism or learning disability would be able to be sectioned under section 2, but not under section 3, unless they have a condition that would fall under the Mental Health Act. So they wouldn't just have an autism or learning disability. They might have something like schizophrenia or personality disorder as well. And I think my worry about that is we already know within the service, there's thousands of people who are treated with autism and a learning disability, and the responsible clinicians and people working with them don't understand those conditions. They're not trained in it. The environment they work in isn't made to support it. So when you look at that bigger question, when somebody with an autism or learning disability won't go on unless they've got a further mental health problem, there's a real risk that because the people that are assessing our young people actually might not have a good understanding of autism, might be wrongly diagnosing conditions to be able to detain them under section 3. It's been really good to read about the changes to the care and treatment review process. We've been an expert by experience who sits on the panel of the care and treatment reviews. Quite often it's frustrating when review after review, it comes up that nothing's actually been actioned in the plans that you've put in place to help a person. So every review, you might sit there and feel a little bit disappointed for that person. You, as a panel, have come up with some good ideas, but none of them have been taken forward or actioned. And those things can be quite imperative to help a person be supported in an assessment and treatment unit, or important to stop them being admitted to hospital in the first place. So one of the new parts of the Act would be that the responsible clinician has a statutory requirement to explain why any actions aren't carried out that are suggested by the panel. And I believe that's also going to be incorporated within the actual care plans that will be put in place for people in hospital as well. And if, again, they're not acted upon, it would need to be explained by the responsible clinician as to why not. So I think that's really positive. It would have been better if that would be extended to the person's case manager and people within the community, just to give that whole person approach to make sure that everybody working towards discharge is working for that person and equally accountable. By having the care and treatment review, we put forward lots of recommendations to help a person get out of hospital to get the better care that they should be having. And when you've just got one person overseeing that and saying that's right or wrong, it's just one opinion and one person. Whereas when you have a wider network, it makes everybody think together. So it wouldn't just be around the hospital, it would be around the community as well. And that's key, that making everybody work together for the purpose of the young person that's detained. So under the new rules, it's been identified that the nearest relative isn't always a productive person. Potentially, they might not want to be involved with the young person. They might not want or have the capacity to deal with things themselves. So under the new guidance and within the advanced choice document, a person will state, instead of a nearest relative, a person of choice, somebody that they feel can support them during their time in hospital. They're happy for them to have information shared about them. And whilst I think it is good, absolutely, to give that person the right, I can't help but worry, just because of my own personal experience. I became a nearest relative simply because of the law. I was that person. It was dedicated to me. And I do worry that if my child suddenly thought, I don't know, a friend or acquaintance was a better person, I'd be worried about that choice. So yeah, I think that is something that I found quite interested reading and would probably want a bit more clarity over it for my own understanding. But I do worry that sometimes it's very easy to pick somebody you think will be supportive who might not always be. But that's just personal circumstances rather than the Act itself. But I can see how lots of people in similar situations to me might be thinking, oh, I've been this person's nearest relative for X amount of years, and actually that now might change. And that can lead to really interesting conversations. And I believe there is framework going to be put in place around that. But ultimately, the person has to be at the heart of it, and it has to be what they want. So whilst I'm sat here saying, oh, this is new, this is a bit scary for me, it is the right thing, in my opinion. If somebody has autism or a learning disability, or both, and it is said that they have a mental health problem that, you know, accompanies that, then they can be detained under Section 3. And I worry about that, because once you're detained, you're going to a hospital, and there's nothing within this Act that states that that has to be a specialist hospital, that that has to be a hospital that will be able to accommodate your sensory needs, your profile, your everything that you need to get you through a day. There's nothing within the Act that says that you would be in the appropriate environment. We know historically that responsible clinicians and the staff in the units have very little, if any, training in autism or learning disabilities. So I think my worry is how would they be looking to treat that person? Because you can't treat autism or a learning disability. That is that's who you are. And when you have a mental health problem aside, on, you know, as well as that, how will they treat you? How will they make sure that it's not too loud, it's not too bright, there's not too many people, you're getting the medication when you want it, when you need it? How will they make sure that you're seeing your family enough? How will they make sure that you've got everything that you need? How will they keep you safe? How will they do those things when there's nothing to say you're not going to be taken? Well, for example, we had to travel a 600-mile round trip for 4 years to see our son. So you used to have to fly to see him. So what's to say that's not going to happen? What's to say that the unit is so far from home, you're not going to see your family, you're not going to see your friends? Not all units have internet access, even now. It's just really scary when you're not very well and you have autism or a learning disability, being taken away from familiarity and everybody you know who can support you is the hardest thing ever. And then to not have any guidance around the type of hospital you should go to, or at the very least, the responsible clinician has a really good understanding of autism or learning disability. That is a big concern of mine. It's very difficult because we don't want our young people to be in hospital. So we don't want hospitals. But if somebody has to go in a hospital, we need to make sure they're getting the right treatment in the right environment. But because we don't want the hospitals, there's very limited environments that are appropriate. I think if they were to say we're creating more provision, there would be arms thrown up in the air saying this is not what we want, which is absolutely right. But without the provision, people can't get well. But the thing I don't understand is why every provision that there already is can't have an appropriate unit within that provision. Quite often it's not rocket science, I have to be really honest. And a little bit like schools, where schools have to be inclusive, perhaps the hospital should have to be inclusive. Where training at the moment is quite minimal and quite basic, perhaps it needs to be more regulated and intense. One of the things I think could have been looked at that isn't looked at is something that I personally really struggle with, and it's about a conflict. At the moment, if you're in hospital, the person that decides if you're leaving the hospital is a responsible clinician who's employed by the hospital. Now, stepping aside from an NHS hospital, this is more specific to private providers, which hold a lot of the market. A person detained in hospital would cost upwards of at least £500,000 a year. And that's paid to the hospital that decides whether or not they can leave. And I find that is a really big conflict of interest. I really hoped that that was something that would have been looked at and a more independent body be involved in the process to prevent our families and friends and people with autism and learning disabilities being used as cash cows, because ultimately that's what it is. If somebody is just being held because they're autistic or just being held because of a learning disability, then it's not right in the first instance. But knowing that only the hospital can say they can leave, but the hospital are being paid an awful lot of money to keep them there, it doesn't feel right. And it's the biggest conflict of interest I think I've ever come across in my life. And I don't think it'll ever change, but if I could change one thing, it would be that. The majority of the time we've been through the system, it's been within children's services, so it's been a bit different. But going into adult services, there was a big change. With the right support, advocacy I think is going to be a big point. I want to touch on that a little bit. But with the right support, being able to access more tribunals and question the detention, with more powers within tribunals so that actually it can be insisted somebody's moved to a less secure hospital or actually into the community, there are some really positive points. The advocacy service, it's quite an interesting one. Advocacy is quite, well, it's seen to be quite informal. And I think through lots of care and treatment reviews that I've taken part in, but also through my own experience, quite a lot of the advocates are absolutely right-minded and wanting to help people, but don't necessarily have the understanding of somebody with autism or a learning disability. And that has, in some ways, prevented somebody getting help that they need. I think we need to make sure that's regulated. We need to make sure it's a good high standard. And especially where we're now talking where advocates are going to help somebody apply for, you know, a tribunal. They're going to help people fill out their advanced choice document. They're going to very much be part of somebody's time in hospital. And I think to make that work, absolutely, we need to make this the best service it can be. Make sure they've got all the tools in their box to help that person and have a really good knowledge and understanding of how actually the environment can be just as dangerous as the mental health conditions that somebody might have. But I think it's imperative moving forwards. And I, whilst I understand there's a fear of it being not so informal, maybe it doesn't need to be informal. Maybe it needs to be what's right for the person, and that's to have a good understanding of their needs. And when you put all of those things together, the fact that you'd have a good advocate, you're choosing the person who you want to be supportive of you out of hospital, you're able to access the tribunals, you can have care and treatment reviews where their actions actually have to be followed, and if they're not, there has to be a really good reason why, and it has to be justified. There are some really good points within the paper. We were told 9 years ago that our son had to go to hospital and he had to be sectioned, and that that would be for 9 months at the most. And following that, it's 9 years later. He's still in hospital. It's been fraught with fear, fighting fire with fire, not being listened to, his need not being met, and very little understanding. And my fear is, moving forwards, for other people who are just starting that journey, that they would go through the same. And whilst some of the changes that have been implemented or will be implemented are really positive, the advocacy, more tribunals, the advanced choice document, the care and treatment reviews, there's some really positive pieces within there, but there is still this massive gaping hole where our loved one and others with autism or learning disability could be exposed to the level of abuse and misunderstanding that we've gone through that's led to nearly 10 years locked away for nothing more than having a learning disability and going to crisis point age 13. The government have said that obviously community placements and community support needs to be at its best. It needs to be really well funded. It needs to be specific. And that needs to start, in my opinion, in the very early days of nursery schools with family support, quick diagnosis, and quick action upon diagnosis, not just a smiley sticker service, lip service as it be. There needs to be really good intervention. And once those things are in place and that funding is there, then hopefully those people, you know, as they hit their adult life, hopefully it wouldn't impact them how things are impacted now. And the question of admission wouldn't even be on the table because the support would have been there from the early years. That part is the part the government also really need to focus on and invest heavily into.